Bonnie Gillespie, welcome to the show. I've done an intro which people can check out because you really need no introduction as far as I'm concerned. How are you? How's life treating you in these crazy times?
It's crazy times. I keep saying it's interesting times. It's time for me to make sure that I can stay of service and stay healthy and stay focused on what my zone of genius is for being able to help things be awesome in the world. And so that's helping as many people as possible get on their biggest stage and have their biggest reach. So stay focused on that. I do okay.
And that's historically being, you know, pure play actors and creatives. And I guess that's still a huge part of your audience. But we were just talking there a little bit before hitting record here. It's kind of opening up to a wider group of people just generally, right? Which is exciting, but also I guess maybe has its own reservations or challenges or mind fucks that come with that?
You know, I always had a secret stash of clients from the very beginning when I first started coaching who were non-actors but were attracted to the self-management for actors pillars and the structure to it. I always got emails from people saying, you know, this book isn't just for actors. And I would go, shh, it's got actors right there in the title. Don't mess this up. You got to have your niche. But I always had like politicians or agents, people who are in the industry, but not actors, anybody who's like creative. I had, a former professional wakeboarder champion who came to me because he was now doing his next chapter because he was too old to do the wakeboarding at the same level he used to be. So I've always had some non-industry folks in my group, in my coaching collective there. But more recently, yeah, it's become a thing that I can just say, yeah, I actually have something that we can do that is a little more self-management for all creatives. And that's getting really exciting to see that come together because it allows me to help even more people.
I like the parallel of that story because it kind of aligns with what you teach just the actors, I suppose, anyway, right? Which is own your wheelhouse and then you can open up eventually. It's the whole Tom Cruise playing Tom Cruise like he did, or Jim Carrey being the slapstick comedy guy until eventually he does Eternal Sunshine or whatever it might be. And, you know, it's great because, you know, practice what you preach, but that is it, right?
For sure. Because I know that if I come at the world going, I can do all these things, absolutely no one is turned on by that. But if instead I go, here's this thing I do incredibly well, no one can beat me, this is what you come to me for, I get enough of a fan base there that then people start noticing, there's more to this. And I can go, yes, there is. In fact, here's what I have on offer. And then we can spread out from there. And that's true for actors. Absolutely.
That's awesome as well, talking about it now, because people can look at you and research you. And, you know, some people know you, others are getting to know you, but you're established as a brand pretty strongly now, right? But if we go back to, when was it, 99, when you were like first interviewing people in the casting world? Like, if you, what was that like as a period in time? Because you can't have obviously thought back then, this is what my empire is going to be. Maybe an idea loosely, but.
No, not even. In 99, I'm an actor and this is a survival job. I have a whole bunch of little disposable jobs that are super freelance, super low impact in terms of if I'm going to miss it, I'm not going to get fired and lose all my money. It's like no golden handcuffs jobs, just a bunch of little random jobs. And one of them happened to be interviewing casting directors. So fantastic actor job because I get in with all the people that wouldn't see me if I showed up with a headshot. But showing up with a micro cassette recorder and a notepad, they're like, yeah, come on in, sit. You want to watch sessions? You want to hear us talking with producers after the actors leave? And I'm like, all the yes, I want all of that. But at that time, it was just an actor survival job that happened to be also really cool in terms of the amount of information it helped me get about how to navigate my own auditions. But within 6 months, I was like, oh, I'm not here to be an actor. I'm here to do this. Pull back the curtain on what it is that's going on in these sessions. Because again, 99, as you mentioned, like that's a different world. That's sure. There's no database of information of what it's like to be in front of casting directors. No one's sharing behind it. We didn't even have DVD behind the scenes extras of what casting looked like at that point. So the process was very mysterious. And it was just all about go in and demystify that process. it wasn't until 2003 when I had by then published the first book, which was Casting Cues, which was just a collection of the casting director interviews, and had answered so many emails from people who were reading my stuff going, well, what's the rule? Because they would say, you know, well, this one said that. What's the actual rule? And I'm like, there is no actual rule, but let me see if I can at least see what the data is telling us. And it's more likely this, in general this, but if you're in this niche, if you're in that niche, da da da. At that point, I had answered so many questions well that Keith, my then fiance, now husband, says, I think this is a book. And I'm like, no, that's just where I've answered questions really well. And it's just the patterns. And he's like, yeah, I think that's actually a book. So there was no, could I have imagined where this was going to be? It was, I think I'm here to interview casting directors for several years. And then Self-Management for Actors was born. And that's when I went, oh, this is what I've been doing for the past few years. Yeah.
And then just trying stuff and testing stuff and seeing what comes back. And I think the reason I was kind of alluding to that is because that is pretty much the key staple of anything that anybody can do in life, which is try something, see what happens, get the feedback, and then readjust and go again, or don't. But if you don't try, you don't know, I guess is.
Well, we get stuck in our head of like, you know, running scenarios. How's it going to be? If I do it this, you know, will it look like this? We cannot build anything from a place of what if. We've got to get in there and actually create it and get some data. And then we may learn, yeah, this was shit. This was horrible. Nobody likes this. Don't ever do that again. But at least we now know. But we've got to get out there and try it, which is why I say launch at 85%, which is get ready enough that you're not starting at zero, but you've got enough that you're pretty sure is a thing that you go out and test it, get data, and then recalibrate from there.
And so quickly, I guess, if we touch on SMFA and some of its main tenets, what does that look like from an actor's perspective? You know, I might have some people that know your work already, but for those that don't, how do you collect data? What does that look like? And in this, I know it's a big question, right? Especially in this period that we're in, like most actors just think it's, I got to get an agent and then I go and have my auditions and I book my job. And it's very linear, even though it's not linear. That's the ladder idea, right? And then you're right. Why am I waiting for 8 months for an audition? My phone's not ringing. I hate my life. That's not where you're coming from. But what's the tenets of SMFA that kind of ground that and then add so much more onto it to make you feel empowered? Because that's the key of what you do, really. You're empowering actors, not just...
Yeah, well, because I could have a massive business just anointing actors their type and making referrals to agents. And it would be the shittiest job of my life. I would not want to do that. There are, however, people who make a lot of money off actors doing that sort of thing, especially here in LA. And I like teaching actors how to go find that out for themselves. And there are, of course, slackers out there who don't want to figure out how to do it themselves. And so they resist that. How much can I pay you to actually just tell me my type? And I'm like, you don't want to know what I think. You want to know what I and another 100 people think. Because from there, you can track the patterns. You can dismiss the outliers. You can actually see what the data is telling you and lean into that. And then sure, you can steer that as you go, as you continue to build up the know, like, trust factor in different casting offices, they'll let you expand outside of your original bullseye. But you've got to get in doing that thing that is your specialty, and you learn what that is by getting data. So before you're at a point where you're getting data from the bookings, you're getting data from the auditions. Like, what are you getting called in on? And I actually like looking at the bookings, the put a pin in you, the avail, the so close, you know, it was down to you and one other guy, the callback, then just the straight audition. And then from there, I think we can get a pretty good idea of the level of specialty that gets narrowed in the farther up through that we go. And so when people are like, well, I have a bunch of student films or plays and like, no, I'm not getting paid for these things. And I'm like, the data's a little mushy there. Because before you're getting paid, you can have a lot of range. You can do a lot of things because you're willing to work for free. But when people at the professional level are paying you to do the work, they are paying you to be a specialist. And of course, creatives die a little when I say that because they're like, I want to do all the things. And I'm like, you can, just not at first. you got to get in and teach them that you're reliable, you're professional, you got your shit together, and then you're going to be able to expand from there because now you have a fan base. Just to go back to your original question on this, self-management for actors is four pillars. It's knowing your type and brand and knowing how to get that data right there. That's targeting your buyers and marketing toward them and knowing that not all buyers are your buyers and that's okay, which then helps you deal with the rejection part of things because not everybody's meant to get you. And then the third one is content creation, making sure that you have stuff out there that showcases exactly what it is that you do best. You know a little something about that, Ashley?
No.
And then the fourth one is networking and pitching, because you got to be able to connect with the people or else they're not going to know you exist. And then all of that is wrapped up in the secret fifth pillar, which is mindset. Because if your head's not in the right place, it doesn't matter. You can have all that other stuff together. You're never going to make it very far.
And that's interesting because obviously I look at my journey with working with you and it's, I think 7 years ago, I had my first coaching session, but I'd been doing the work a few years before that with SMFA Essentials and the book. And when I came in, there's no SMFA Essentials anymore, is there?
As soon as I heard you say that phrase, I was like, oh, he doesn't know. We're about to completely rebrand that and release it this year.
Oh, really?
So you just got a scoop.
Ah, there we go. Scoop. But I remember, like, you know, it's like you're going through, or my experience was going through the process with you of, okay, I'm going to figure out the brand. I'm going to get content aligned with that and the shows I want to be in and all this stuff. And then my experience, and maybe it'd be good if you could speak to this to see if other people have a similar one, was eventually I didn't think about it anymore, right? Like I didn't think, oh, I need to go in as the confident but mysterious kind of guy. Like I wasn't conscious of that, where I had been for a long time doing the work. And then it got to the point where it's not that I didn't care, but the mindset thing was more of the thing that I was. It's more like all those other four pillars are actually to lead you to strong mindset, as opposed to those pillars are like your safety blanket. That's my journey through it anyway.
I like to say the mindset is the medicine we hide in the ice cream, because so many people start out going, I have to get an agent. I have to get in the union. I have to move to a major market. There's just so much that is results oriented for most creatives at the beginning of their journey. And I have to serve that, because if I don't, I don't have anybody even pulling my book off the shelf in a bookstore and going, what is this? So there has to be a certain amount of almost actor busy work, but it's not, it's foundational work. It's results oriented work, which the whole time I'm doing that, I'm laying the groundwork for, but you don't care about the results. Yes, I'm going to help you get results, but you don't care about that. Like, it's building relationships. It's long game, but yes, here are some short game things that you can have, because you have to have some wins. So the buy-in has to include the wins in order for someone to stick with me long enough and have success enough that they then go, none of that matters. Like, got it. I now stayed in this long enough to know it's all mindset. It's all relationships. It's long game, build fans that just come from like, I just know I want to work with you. And I don't care how, we're going to figure it out. That's the big picture. Got it. All that other stuff I thought was important, not so much. And then of course, all of that stuff starts taking care of itself once you get the mindset cleaned up and you're in it for the long haul. Because if you're in it for the long haul, you're just like, I want to help tell stories. I want to be a part of awesome projects with awesome people. How can we make that happen? And coming from that point of view aligns you with people who are more attracted to what it is that you do. They can take you up to a higher level. We see this again and again with clients at every level, except for the very beginning stages. Because at the beginning, you're just like, get me that agent. And I'm like, the agent I can get you right now, you're later going to go, why? Why did I do that? So yeah, it's playing kind of both of those layers, I guess, at once, but hoping that enough of that medicine gets in through that ice cream that the right people go, got it, now I know what to do here. And then the rest takes care of itself.
Yeah, because it's a self-awareness game, right? Just like anything that you're doing in life. And I think sometimes that probably comes with experiences and just hitting the brick wall or having a few bad agents or bad auditions or not getting anything. And then having to look inwards a little bit and go, why do I really want this? And what is it that I really want? Like, is it I want to book the series reg role, which maybe it is, but why? It's that old, you know, Simon Sinek thing of what is your why? And
very much so, very much so. But it's also, it's what are you trying to get validated by the industry because you don't have your own resting state of enoughness? And so much of the work that we do now and why most of my work is now very appealing to people outside acting and outside show business, in fact, is because there's this resting state of enoughness that comes from, look, I can be in a career where I get rejected almost every day and still know that I'm okay. I cannot get that role and still know I'm okay. I can not get that agent. I can get dropped at the end of a pilot season that didn't go so well, and I still know I am enough. That right there is the key to everything. Because once you've got that resting state of enoughness, it doesn't matter about the micro. The macro is I'm on that road to my true north, to sharing my big why. I am now, if the why was I need to feel validated, the industry is only going to chew you up. But if the why is I want to tell these great stories, I want to be a part of these wonderful opportunities and experiences with fantastic people and leave behind some things that other people can look at someday and go, wow, that really moved me. Like, that's a good why.
Yeah, I think the way I've kind of seen it is to be more of a creator than just a consumer, you know, like balance the two. It's fine to be a consumer. Like, I think you have to be, right? Especially in the world we live in, but you can't just be the one that only binges Netflix if you're, you know, an actor and don't want to create something that could be on Netflix or whatever it might be, a business, a side hustle, or whatever satiates just your spirit on some level that makes you not worry about, is the phone going to ring for that next gig or agent? And I think once you do that, then you can kind of find that vessel to tell your stories and other people's stories.
That goes back to being empowered, though, because if you know, okay, I'm here because I want to tell these stories, then you stop waiting for someone else to give you the keys to that car. You go, oh, I actually can go ahead and create and tell those stories right now. So back to beginnings of my world here in self-management for actors, interviewing all these casting directors, 99, you couldn't create your own content for less than $30,000, $45,000. And it just wasn't possible. And of course, today, everybody's got a phone that has a camera that's nicer than one we would have spent $5,000 on a couple of years ago. And there is no excuse in terms of platforms that can sustain what it is that you've created. There's no excuse. You need to be creating your stuff constantly. And that's the most empowering thing you can do because it allows you to live your why before someone else has given you permission or let you in through the gate.
Now, I totally agree. Now, let's go to the mindset part of that question, which is obviously the big part of it, which is some people will get a huge amount of resistance to that, which is totally natural. It's that whole Robert Pressfield thing of when you get resistance, that's a good sign, but what are you going to do with it? How do you help people try to sort of navigate that initial block of, but who am I to put something out there, you know, or who am I to speak up, or why should I put something out if it doesn't, you know, it's that thing you always talk about, perfectionism being the death of creativity. Right. And all those stories we tell ourselves to say, hey, don't do the podcast on Zoom that looks ghetto as fuck, or whatever it might be, or don't write the book that your husband told you to write at the time, because it's not a book.
Oh, I had that. I totally was like, this isn't a thing. This couldn't be a thing. And that's actually the story that I share so that people will go, oh, this thing, self-management for actors, that has so changed my life, and I can look at Bonnie in 2020 and see the empire she's built, that almost didn't happen because she was having the exact same, who am I, what is this, this is nothing, there's no value resistance in 2002, 2003 that could have kept that from ever becoming. And so I think you have to do a little future tripping. You have to go, there's a future version of me that's glad I at least got started because I'm going to be better at this. And so in content creation, this is called your first pancake, which is you put your shitty first draft, you put that first pancake out there. It's not something you want to serve to guests because it's, you know, raw here and lumpy here and burned on one side and whatever. You feed it to the dog, you know, whatever. But you got the pan warmed up and now you're ready to make pancakes that actually look gorgeous. But you can't get there without going through that first one that's awful. I mentioned my first book was Casting Cues. That book has not only typos, there's an entire chapter in which I renamed a casting director. I introduced her by her real name, and then a third of the way into the interview, I just renamed her. And the whole rest of the interview, it's a different name. And I didn't catch it. Editing didn't catch it. Proofers didn't catch it. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm mortified. And I go, that's why that's your first book, which has sold thousands of copies. And your second is Self-Management for Actors, which is, of course, built an empire. So you've got to get that first one out, because it's where you're going to learn. It's where you're going to make mistakes. It's where you're going to make mistakes in front of the smallest audience you will ever have. And so there's got to be something that lets you say, even if I doubt that I'm the one to be telling this story, there's a way to lower the stakes to make it safe to try. And that's why, coming back to that, what stories do I want to tell? I just want to have fun. I just want to get this put together. It may be shit. I may never put it out in the world. It may look ghetto as fuck, whatever phrase works for you. At least I got it going. And it's sort of that Brené Brown getting into the arena thing. You got to try, because only then will you know, yep, never want to do that again. Or I learned a lot. Now the next one's going to actually be something worth looking at.
And it's one of those things where we're in an era now, and I'm going a bit broader than just actors, but it applies to all of us, which is that notion of, you know, old school academic teaching that has systematically taught us to think a very specific way, which is cultural as well. For some cultures, it's even more hardcore than others. But generally speaking, we are taught to be good worker bees if we've gone through that sort of system. Now, as actors and creatives, we obviously aren't necessarily wired that way directly, but there is still that part of the system, if you're only thinking of the system, that has traits to that. Like, I have to appease the casting person. I've got to book the job, all that stuff. So much like anybody in a regular 9-to-5, there's that dissonance of, but I don't even know what that looks like, because nobody's taught me. Like, I was taught when I was a kid, if I don't get an A+, that I failed. And if I get it a D, there's something wrong with me. And even though we consciously know that, that's a lot of rewiring that takes a lot of time. So it might not be an easy answer to that question, but obviously with you doing more mindset stuff now, more and more, like, how do you help people try and gently and with kindness sort of rewire that?
So are you familiar with Gretchen Rubin's Four Tendencies at all?
Not, and I know of her, but I've not gone deep into.
She's got a few books. The better book is called Better Than Before, if you're new to her and want to check her out. But she has this test of the four tendencies. And when you take the test, you determine if you are an obliger, which everybody hates getting that result because it means that you want to please others. 70% of the population, obligers. Like, that's probably that's what almost everybody is. And then there are questioners, which have to question everything, and they make you crazy because everything's a debate about, well, why is it like this? Why is it like this? Then there are rebels, which it doesn't matter why it's like this. They just want it to be different. And then there are upholders, which are the smallest portion of the population. And those are the ones who are going to do what they say they're going to do. They're going to get things done because they said it will be. I'm one of those. I'm an upholder. I am the rarest of the group. Most of my clients are not what most of the population happen to be, which are obligers. They are questioners and rebels. And I have to look at that and go, why does Self-Management for Actors line up with questioners and rebels? And I'm like, because show business lines up with questioners and rebels. Entrepreneurship lines up with questioners and rebels. People who question, why is it this way? And people who see it as it is and go, well, it doesn't have to be that way. So the questioners and the rebels are the ones who will say, I'm going to go in and attempt something different, or at least question it enough that I feel the way that I come at it, yes, may have to go on that linear way, may have to follow those rules, may have to be a bit of that rewiring from childhood, but I'm going to be open to, it doesn't have to be this way just because it's always been this way. So right out the gate, I love that the people who are most attracted to my work are the ones who go, why does it have to be this way? And they can see a different world. The thing is, if you grew up being one of those and constantly getting in trouble for it, you became either an upholder, minority of the folks, or an obliger, the majority of the folks. because you were whipped into, I have to fit in. I have to be the worker bee. I have to be a good, it's what the educational system in most countries is trying to create, a good worker bee, a good follower. Leaders don't do well in school. And they do well if they look a certain kind of way and can be president of the class and beta club and all the whatever, you know, like if they follow the rules and toe the line and still look enough like establishment that they're doing everything right, those leaders can do okay. They're approved. But the leaders like us tend to spend a lot of time in the principal's office, get detention, get in trouble, get suspended. And so we will do what it takes to try and fit in and make it work. And part of the work of enoughness with adults is we're excavating what we lost. So it's less of how do we do the rewiring and more of how do we heal the part of ourselves that we betrayed in order to get by in a society that forced us to do that. Mm-hmm. So it's hard. It is emotional. And that's why the mindset work is so freaking important, because you've got to come at a place where you can come together with that version of yourself that you tucked in because you were young and you had to get by, and your survival was not up to you. It was up to adults around you. So you had to hide and push that stuff down. So much of the work of recovering the creative adult is allowing yourself to be all those things that you started out being and making it okay as often as possible, while forgiving the part of you that had to kind of hide that in order to fit in. Because we had to. We were doing what we had to do. It's survival.
Yeah, it's a lot of old inner child stuff, isn't it? And kind of just, you know, at what point did that kid feel like they couldn't actually vocalize whatever they wanted to vocalize?
Sometimes at physical risk. Sometimes at literal physical risk. Absolutely. And that's why it's such emotional work.
It's interesting because you remember things when you were a kid that you have no reason to remember. And like there's those flashback images. I remember being reprimanded in gym class when I was 5 for not lining up with the rest of the group, because at that point I was in my head thinking I was a Ninja Turtle or something. I think that's what I was doing. I think I was literally spinning on the ground like I had a shell on my back.
Yes.
But that's not what I remember. What I remember was being scolded by the teacher, whose name I don't remember, whose face I don't remember. But that, still now at 36, still is in my mind. And I know what it is and what the trigger is. But it's a teacher now. But at the time, you're like, I've done something wrong, so I'm not going to do that again.
Yep.
And we all have zillions of those things from,
and that's right around the age that it happens. It's 5, 6, 7, 8, that sweet spot right there. Everybody's got a thing that they can point to exactly like that, where they go, oh, that's where I remembered, that's where I learned you're too much. Put that away. You're too big for your britches, too big for your boots. Like there's different phrases for it, where the tall poppy syndrome in Australia, like this is where it gets planted. And so if we can go back to that and realize we had to tuck it in because we had to survive that culture, and then forgive all of that, which is a lot of work, and allow ourselves to reclaim that, we actually have a shot at living the fullest versions of ourselves that we were put on this planet to live.
And I don't know if anyone's anything like me, I resonate with all of that, but then I also go, what's the science? Like for me personally, you know, and I like, you know, meditation, for example, is a way of maybe tapping into that. But I, until recently, would never, it's not that I didn't get meditation. It's that I couldn't correlate the science and the energy behind it and what it was actually doing in a way that felt right for me. Until I started getting into the world of people like, say, Dr. Joe Dispenza and Bruce Lipton, who scientifically talk about it from a quantum science perspective. And then for someone like me, I'm like, well, now I get it, because it helps my logical brain and my non-logical side kind of piece it together. And I think that's when you go, oh, well, shit, fuck. When you're like 5, 6, your brain is still operating on a different level.
That's right.
That it's a program that you're not even aware of. And then from that point of view, you can be a lot kinder about these things when you were a kid. And, but again, that's a lot of wanting to go inwards, which is scary because Netflix is an easier choice.
And a lot of artists chose the artist path and the creative path specifically because it's a way to escape going inward or spending time with this version of ourselves that we had to become. So when I say, look, what you're doing when you go within is bringing back the version of yourself that you like and that you want to hang out with. That, yeah, you don't want to become, you don't want to spend time with this person that you had to become because that person's a fucking poser, but you had to become that in order to get by. So yeah, it's a lot of deep, dark, get in the murky of it. Here's the good news. I've done this now with enough clients to know it actually is easier and faster than we worry it will be. Sure. So it's a lot like creating your own content. You go, well, I'm going to talk myself out of it because it's too hard. I don't know enough about how to do it. I have no idea what the results are going to be. I'm going to hemorrhage money. So I just won't do it. Similarly, going in and doing the inner work, yeah, it's a slog. I'm not going to lie. It sucks. There are moments where you're like, oh God, I liked it better when I could just be drunk and not self-aware. Like there are going to be moments like that. And they're not going to last that long because just looking back and like, I'm assuming even in this conversation we've had, you're looking back to Ninja Turtle Kid at 5 and going, oh, we've got some work to do. And that connection right there is already healing. And the healing starts happening immediately because we heal faster when we're younger. So going back and talking to that little kid actually gets shit fixed at rapid pace. And there's the science behind that, of course, which Dr. Joe talks about, Bruce as well. Also, anybody who does modern flow theory, if you look at Stephen Kotler, who I just was on a masterclass with last night, and I'm just like, my brain just go, I love talking about the science of it. Because it's there. You can look at the brain scans and the way the brain lights up and goes dark and like it, whoo, that stuff's amazing. Use it.
Absolutely. And I think for actors, sometimes you're like, but no, I'm just a creative. I'm just here to, you know, do my thing. And it almost feels like this is a lot of structure and work and like all these things that I guess I'm trying to allude to the fact that our acting is enriched by our life, not the other way around.
Yeah.
You know, and tapping into all that stuff. The irony of what you were saying is the poser isn't what we want to see, what we actually want to see and the real good stuff. And when you start probably getting the results that you plan for is when you kind of realign with whoever that kid was or just drop into that enoughness, that ongoing inside work. And, you know, perspective is what be, you know, it's a nice good old swift kick in the balls that we all need, but it gives you that recalibration. I think now with the past 3-4 months that people have been living through, there's a lot of perspective shift, I think, that is maybe a silver lining to come out of this.
Yeah, we're being forced to live an experience that we have had a lot of conveniences helping us avoid for, in some cases, decades. And when we no longer have any of those convenient distractions and we really have to sit with ourselves, there's some reckoning there, you know, and for some it's really troubling. And there of course is a massive mental health issue on the heels of the pandemic that I know we have to face. But for those who are willing to use the time and go inward and try meditation, try self-love, try forgiveness, try tapping, try like whatever it is that feels like an experiment in going inward that doesn't terrify them, then they realize it's actually not that terrifying at all. And the beauty that comes from that, of course, then informs your work, of course, affects your relationships. It changes your financial set point. Like everything gets better when we're willing to actually be our authentic selves.
And I think one of the key words in what you said was experiment in many ways. It's just try, you know, yeah. It's give it 21 days or whatever the science says you need to give or whatever you're comfortable with, but just get that new habit going. And if it's not for you, move on and move to something else. And the reason I think I picked up on that word is the whole going back to the entrepreneurship and obviously the way that you kind of bootstrapped yourself up, it's trying, it's trying, it's trying. And that's what you're teaching actors and creatives and even non-creatives that come to you. It's how to, I guess, deploy that entrepreneurial mindset to whatever creative endeavor that we're embarking on. But again, my resistance word comes up because for actors, the idea of being an entrepreneur, even though you inherently are, has more of a business connotation. So again, how do you help people, I guess, merge those two worlds together so beautifully? Because no one else really quite does it to the depths that you do, in my opinion.
Thanks. And that's a really good question. I know for me personally, I compartmentalize. Like, that's my superpower, is I compartmentalize, and I know that there are times I clock in for one kind of thing and I clock in for another kind of thing, and I don't look over there and go, how's that doing while my work is here in this department? Because it's when I'm working on the nuts and bolts that if I look over there to spirituality or mindset or some deep, dark inner child wound or whatever, that I will have resistance take me off what it is that I'm trying to do with the nuts and bolts of it. So I know for me personally, compartmentalization is the key, but for how I teach others, because compartmentalization is also a survival mechanism from a broken childhood. You compartmentalize so you don't have to feel the pain of going through XYZ. And so it allows you to be like, I'm not really here. This isn't happening to me. My body is not me. You do all of those. So it's comes from an unhealthy place, but I turn it into a superpower. And I think a lot of us do that and we don't realize it. I would say probably understanding that, and this goes back to the culture that you had to get okay with and you had to survive in. I think it gets into, don't make it wrong that you couldn't figure out how to do both the mindset and the nuts and bolts earlier in life, because you weren't allowed to kind of do that. And so every time you try to heal the mindset and work on the nuts and bolts, I'm running a business, but I'm also dealing with this enoughness thing. It feels like, oh, this is so messy. And if your reaction to that is, that's okay, experiments can be messy, you keep going. And if instead you go, yep, that's wrong, something must be, I'm doing it wrong, we go back into that, how do I please the authority figure, how do I tuck in my full expression of myself? If we get back into that loop, we never actually heal that old stuff, and we also create new wounds now. So I think it's an understanding that we are going to have to clock in for mindset work every day. Like, for instance, money mindset. I do money mindset work every day. I have a money mindset coach. I have work that I do every single day because I know I came up from some really horrible truths about money and the ability to sustain yourself as an artist. And I'm rewriting those every day. And so part of the work is I show up every day for what's future me going to be. Oh, and go back to the science of this. There's a place, the medial prefrontal cortex actually goes dark when we think of our future selves. And it also goes dark when we think of strangers, which means we associate our future selves with stranger and we have less empathy for that stranger. We have less reason to do good things for that future self. It's why we won't go get certain medical tests now, because it's future me that benefits from the knowing, and right now me has to go through that unpleasant thing, and I don't want to do that. So screw that future me, she'll figure it out. That's exactly the brain science behind that. So part of the work is bring future me into focus now by doing exercises like future tripping journaling, talking with yourself about, here I am holding up my golden shiny thing, and this is the speech that I give, not just from the fantasy, doesn't that feel good point of view, although that's awesome, but from the logistical, I am trying to make this connected enough to my now that I can then do the things that are less glamorous and less fun that have to lead up to that eventuality. But we don't get there if we don't put in the work now.
Yeah, I love that. I had my actual first guest on the show was an old friend from school. He's actually an entrepreneur in solar energy, but he spoke about the notion of what his mentor taught him, which is effectively the gap of that future and where you are now. And I'm going to probably butcher the paraphrasing, but he loosely said his mentor was telling him, look, said Sam, you don't You don't take your ambition and your current skill set and say, here's this gap and I'm feeling some dissonance that's uncomfortable, so I'm going to take my ambition and lower it to match my current skill set. What you do is you gradually look at how you can bring your skill set in line with your future ambition. And that's where the gap part becomes more manageable. But I think a lot of times we look at that gap, and what you're saying, your future visualizing is great, but someone might go, but I don't know, winning an Emmy sounds all nice and fancy schmancy, but that's there. I'm here. How in the blue hell do I get to that? I don't know. So I'm just going to eat Ben and Jerry's all day.
That's right. That's right. And I've been there. I get that. It's challenging to imagine that future me, especially if we've done a lot of self-editing to keep ourselves safe and small. If you've not read The Big Leap by Gay Hendricks, everyone needs to read this. It talks about something called the upper limit problem. And this is where, when we start experiencing successes that are outside the comfort zone of safe, we start self-sabotaging. And that is because, from an evolutionary standpoint, anytime we do something that makes us other, it takes us out of the tribe, which makes us more delicious prey. And we need to stay safe. So we will try to stay like our community, like our family, because that is how we make sure that we don't get left out of the herd and therefore become an easier target for things that are trying to kill us. And just as humans in the world, there is always more stuff out there trying to kill us than we like to keep in mind. And that is something that requires that we put ourselves into a healthier peer group, surround ourselves with people who believe it can be done. I say, if it's the Jim Rohn quote, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with. So you choose those fuckers carefully. Make sure you're picking people. Like, I don't ever want to be the smartest person in the room. If I'm the smartest person in the room, I've entered the wrong room. It's why yesterday was Flow Theory Masterclass, because I gotta be around some people that by the end of our time together, I'm exhausted and I have to go look up some words. And I'm smart. So when I am challenged like that, I know that I've spent some time with some people that are helping me get to future me. So we close that gap by making sure we make play dates with the people that help us see ourselves as that future version of ourselves. And that includes dates with ourselves. And one of the things that I had to do, and this is actually a lesson from my pole fitness journey, is I actually had moments where I was in pole class, crying, frustrated, overweight, can't do it, not fit, just like there's so much that I was struggling with. And I had to say, there is a future me who is a badass at this trick that I can't do right now. And I don't get to meet her if I stop showing up. And that became the mantra for just keep showing up and doing the future me work, because eventually you start to get the future me stuff coming into brighter focus, which of course brings its own panic. And if you watch the Lady Gaga documentary on Netflix, the day she gets the call that she's booked A Star Is Born, her lover leaves because she has a belief that she can't have the success of her dreams in her career and a healthy relationship. And because that belief is there, it will continue to play out until you heal it by doing the work of, I can have it all. It's safe to have it all. I am not a bigger target when I have it all. It is safe to have it all. And rewiring an evolutionary piece of wiring that is way bigger than just you and me right now resistance.
And that there's enough to go around for everybody else. That it's not that if, yeah.
It's not a zero-sum game ever.
Exactly. Yeah. So out there, that's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot to unpack. Any actors that are watching are going to be like, I thought you were going to tell me how to book a job. Like, how does that work? But it's all
there's a great book. It's called Self-Management for Actors. I've got some free training out there that you should get yourself going with. And yes, if you want to go deeper, I've got things where we can go deeper. But I think this is the real work. I know because I work with people at the highest point in their careers, and I have multiple clients who have had the golden shiny moment and the Thank the Academy, I know what the common thread is with success at that level. And it's the willingness to have these conversations.
And those shiny things last about a week. I always remember the Robin Williams quote after winning the Oscar for Good Will Hunting, where he was just like, week one, everybody's congratulations, way to go. Week two, hey, Mork.
Yep.
And you know, that then is nothing wrong with aiming for those things. I think,
but that's why, that can't be your why. That's exactly why you can't get in it, because you need those things, because those things are fleeting. It's like, you can't have a joy filled result at the end of a shitty journey. The journey has to be filled with joy, or that, and even when you get the end result, it's gonna last a week and then hey, Mork.
And I think the whole thing of, if you're aiming for one of those things, that's fine, but more from the vantage point of, what is that going to ask you to be, become, and experience to potentially achieve that? And even if you don't get it, the aim of that North Star, as you would call it, still allows you to have experiences with other people and places and things that is more enriching than, like, the trophy is the cherry on top of the sundae, right? But,
well, this is truly the go in for the audition not needing the role. This is that. And most people hear that really early in their journey and go, okay, just don't need it. Just don't need it. Just don't need it. And I'm like, no. What it really means is, I'm not on this journey for the awards. I'm not on this journey for the massive bank account. I'm not on this journey for the, hey, it's that guy. Like, I'm on this journey for the rich storytelling with people I respect, and fulfilling an audience with moments that they get while they're looking at the work that I'm doing, not while they're looking at me, while they're looking at the work that I'm doing. That is, I'm not coming into this room needing the role. That's what that means. But you can't get that at the very beginning of your journey, unless when you hear this right now, you go, I suspected that it was bigger than just know your type, get an agent, get in the union, book a job. Yeah. But I think just generationally, we've got a group of people that are having these kinds of conversations, as evidenced by the fact that we are having this conversation, and that you have an audience that is going, yes, more, love this. Yeah, it's important. This is the work.
And I think the beautiful thing of that is that it leads to something that maybe wasn't available 5-10 years ago to actors, for sure. And there's two triggers that maybe, or at least one that comes out of what you just said. If I'm thinking myself of actor back at ground zero, which is, okay, but how the hell do I make money then? And
what is that topic?
You know what I mean? And what does that look like? And 5-10 years ago, different world, maybe. Now, different world. And also the notion of, okay, not just how do I make my money, but if I'm not going in to book a job to tell the stories, how do I tell stories? And yes, these are leading questions. But
okay. Yeah, let's talk on the money thing first, because this is where I go into my Wayback Machine and say, when I first started interviewing casting directors in 99, not only did you never talk about what you did outside of acting, like, you never mentioned your survival job, ever, ever, ever. Not only that, you hid in shame if you got a degree in anything other than acting. Like, it was, I want an actor, and I don't want an actor that also knows how to crew. Because as soon as you tell me you've been on a set in any other position, I worry that you're going to come try and run my set. It's a very different world, where we saw it happened a little bit with 9/11. It happened a little bit with here. Obviously, I'm talking about things that are happening in the States, because as goes Hollywood, so go the rest of the markets. But the writer strike and the economy plummeting in 2008 into 2009, it happened a little bit with that. And coronavirus is now the third of my career in this self-management for actors world, where we're seeing people get more and more open to what else you got. Like, we started in 2008 with, okay, you can be an actor who also directs and also writes and also produces. Like, now that's allowed. And there's still dinosaurs at every turn that are going to say, no, go back to the way it was. And they're dying off, and it's fine. So eventually the boomers will be gone, and we will run this shit. But and we're there. We're really there right now.
Yeah, there's like one Marlboro man left on his horse waiting to just, you know.
Correct. And the thing that happened with coronavirus in particular in our industry is, we saw and are seeing agents and managers and casting directors dusting off their real estate license. Mm. Like, everybody is getting very real about, we don't know where the next buck is going to come from. And actors are like, welcome to my world. Like, we've always lived here in the uncertainty, and we've made it work. So we can be leaders to people who are like, oh crap, I just lost everything that I thought I had. And we're able to go, it's fine. here's how to patchwork quilt a life that you actually love. And that's the kind of teaching that I'm doing right now that is totally lighting me up, because I'm getting to help people get money coming in. And it doesn't have to be off your acting. Your acting may not be that first most lucrative of the businesses that you have going, but how cool that you could create something over here on the side that is lucrative enough that then you can say yes to the job that maybe you're not getting paid to do and be on set for weeks at a time because you were bringing in so much money off this thing that you also happen to be good at, because we no longer have to hide that.
And now you can have a micro business that you can do from anywhere, because hey, office jobs might not be that easy to come by anymore either.
Ever. Yeah.
So it's that thing of, well, how do I fund my acting career? Well, hell, I don't know. If I'm into knitting, maybe I do some online course about knitting, or I do a book and I set up a website. And again, it might be ghetto as fuck at the beginning, and you just, you know, build it up over time and refine it as you can. And I think people feeling more comfortable with that and what the internet provides is actually a blessing of this whole kind of period. It's you know Robert Kiyosaki, the guy who did Rich Dad Poor Dad?
Oh yes. I know the book. I didn't know.
Yeah. So he said a quote a few months ago saying that, look, we're now in the information age. The industrial age is basically a bygone era in terms of how we approach this world of work, or whatever you want to call it, or earning a living. And that it's, you know, he's a pure financial guy, but he's talking about diversifying your assets. Well, that applies across the board in terms of whether it's, you know, if I'm just going to be actor waiting for acting job, I'm screwed. If I'm just going to be corporate employee working for a 9-to-5-er, I'm probably screwed as well.
Yeah.
So how do you diversify your portfolio with whatever it might be?
So I first did this exercise in 2013, where I itemized where all my money was coming from. It was something I'd never done. I built a business. We incorporated in 2002, and I never actually sat down and looked at where does my money come from until 2013. And in late March of 2013, I analyzed all of it and realized I had 18 unique revenue streams. And I went, first of all, no wonder I'm so exhausted. Second, I was like, I am chasing things that are bringing in all sorts of different levels of money. And that's got to stop. I was treating them all the same. So what I did was I listed them in the order of money they brought in for the year. And I drew a line at the $10,000 mark. Anything that brought in more than 10 grand in a year, I could keep feeding. Anything that brought in less than 10 grand, I had to stop feeding. That didn't mean I had to stop offering it, but it meant I had to stop energizing it, because that shit was not helping me reach my financial goals. And so by closing off things like the SMFA Essentials of that version, which is great because now we can reboot with a new version that I'm super excited about. But as we cut off things that were fine and had tens of buyers, it allowed us to put the energy into the things that were going to make a greater difference sooner. And that right there is something I teach actors in our membership course. In Getting Gear for the Next Tier, there is a day, I want to say like day 9 of the 100 days, where I'm like, get ready. You're going to want to stay in bed. You're going to want to eat the Ben and Jerry's. Do that. Soothe yourself, but then get back here, because we got to get your butt in the seat and I got to teach you some money shit. Because as a creative, no one's teaching you the stuff that they're creating the, you know, trust fund kids. Like the kids who grew up in country clubs get taught a thing very young about how to manage money and how to keep more of it on their side and how to invest. Artists aren't taught this. Let's have those conversations. Let's talk about how to bring in money quickly and then how to leverage it once you have it, so that you can spend more time doing the art. And so I force, require, encourage, let's softer words, I encourage sweet artists to have those tougher conversations about really looking at your money and getting real about what it is that you do that brings in more of it per hour. And so let's do a little more of that, so that you can, like, maybe you tutor a little more because you get paid more per hour. And then you can say no to one more bar shift because you're not making as much money bartending, or whatever the examples are in your world. And just then you freed up a 5-hour shift that you can put into your art, because you were working smarter with the money that was coming in during the other hours.
And you're not playing the game of one day I'll be super rich, or I'll have a pension that'll bail me out when I retire or whatever. You can kind of invest for what you want.
Yep.
According.
Yeah, but bringing the money in now allows you to have the ability to spend more of your time the way that you want. And yes, there may be a future you who has something far bigger than what you have in your bank account right now. But one thing that things like what's going on in the world right now teach us is we may not have tomorrow. Yeah. So this, it's an interesting dichotomy that we struggle with connecting with future me for all the dream stuff, the good stuff, but we're all about postponing joy for this day when we get to retire and kick up our feet and enjoy all the good things. And I'm like, or you walk outside and get hit by a bus and you never got to enjoy any of that. Like,
it's bullshit. It's complete bullshit. My dad, who passed away last year, had worked his whole life and had that whole thing of, you know, well, eventually I'll have the money that I've bust my ass for to enjoy some kind of life. And he kind of did, but he got diagnosed with something that they have no cure for. And he got to live a few years at the end on his terms. He was like, I don't want the drugs because they give me a worse life. But it was like, where was that promise of 40 years of working for different companies? And like, we had a good life and we lived real well. Like, I'm not saying we didn't enjoy stuff, but there's that thing of, especially for that generation, that, wait, you might not get 70, 75, 80 and be able to go on a cruise. You know what I mean? And why are you busting your ass for this one day, once upon a time thing?
I'm a big Abraham Hicks listener. I start my day with Abraham Hicks MP3s, and it's Hello Woo. So you've been forewarned, but I'm Hello Woo. So there you go. Now I'm pragmatic woo. But anyway, I love the idea of have that thing you're reaching toward because the reach feels good, but reach from a place that also feels good. Because if you're reaching for the thing that feels good because you hate where you currently are, you can't get there. Because hating where you are clouds up, funks up the energy. We've all been around another human being that we're like, oh, you hate your life. It is unpleasant to be around you. That's how the universe feels about us. If we're sitting here going, I hate my life, I hate my life, but there's a future me that's happy. The universe is like, doesn't work that way. Doesn't work that way. And even if you're not into the law of attraction or the universe working that way or the woo parts of it, how pleasant is it to be someone who hates their life right now? It's just not. It just feels icky. So find things to enjoy about where you are right now. And that's part of why I like talking about the money stuff with people who may only be making tens of dollars right now, because never more important than when you're only making tens of dollars to find ways for that to do more for you, to come more easily, for more of it to stay on your side, and to find more joy in the daily bringing in of any of the money, because every bit of it counts.
And now more than ever, you can do things you enjoy to make a living and make money versus, yeah, again, 5-10 years ago. And I think that people are slowly tweaking onto that, but then it's that thing of, how do I do that? How do I execute that? Oh, I just need a website and I can do an Instagram page, or I can do YouTube videos or whatever. And this
You need a place that shows what you're selling. You need a way to take money. So you've got Venmo, PayPal, something, right? And then you need a way to deliver the thing that you say you can deliver. Those are the only three things you need. And you can even do it without a website. If you are an Instagram type person, the link in bio at Instagram can be the link to your payment portal, and the delivery can be a Dropbox link or a private group on Facebook or whatever. Like, you have to spend nothing to get a business up and running right now. No excuse.
Yeah, I'm with you. And I think, you know, when it finally, just to circle it back to content creation for filmmakers and actors or people that want to put out their own projects that might be monetizable one day, you don't just have to rely on Netflix or Amazon to be the home, or iTunes. Like, same thing applies. If you learn these tips and tricks, set up a website, sell your damn movie yourself, build an audience. And I always kind of like the notion of, look at what they're doing at the top. What do the main actors do? What are the studios doing? If they're spending money in certain areas on certain platforms or whatever it might be, there's a reason. Now, we might not reach the audience of Paramount when they promote a big movie, or Ryan Reynolds talking about Deadpool, but you could have a much smaller micro audience for you as a growing actor or filmmaker. And that wasn't around even 3-4 years ago. And I think this is such an interesting time for creatives and actors because of these tools that are available to you. If we get away from the fact that, oh, well, Facebook, Instagram, how do I feel about them?
Yeah.
Personally or politically or from a data perspective, like, well, they're not going anywhere.
And your data's already gone. Don't get precious about what, oh, I got to make sure they don't know this about me. Honey, they already know everything. You let your phone identify your face so you can unlock it. You're done. You're in the machine. Get out your tinfoil hat. You can't protect on that. This show, Artificial, talk about innovation. So, and that's my Emmy certificate up above that.
That was on Twitch, right?
That show was the first ever show on Twitch that is scripted / improvised / audience responsive. And that's why it won the Emmy, was for this innovation that is letting the audience drive the content while it is being created and edited on multiple video things. So here's what's interesting. Here we are, season 3. Season 3 wasn't supposed to be happening right now. COVID hits, and they go, okay, season 3, we're back up and running. I get the call, Bonnie, I need you to cast these roles. Here are the breakdowns. And I go, hang on. Am I to understand you're going back into production right now? This is April. I'm like, you're going into production right now while everyone is quarantined. There's nobody leaving the house for weeks and weeks right now. And that means Bernie said, shooting from their homes. And I'm like, perfect. For the first time casting this, I can go to any actor anywhere, not just the actors who are here in LA. And I went, I have been saying this is coming forever. And oh my God, I'm a part of it. Like, creatives will figure out a way to create, and we'll figure out a way to do it on the most innovative, most creative way that we can visualize. And then it is, of course, monetizable. But when you say pay attention to what the big guys up there are doing and how they are making their money and where they're investing and what things are happening, all of that is have an eye on someone who is a pace car for you. Someone who is doing it because they have more resources, maybe it looks a little different, but they're showing you, they're role modeling for you what it is that you can start doing on no budget. Because absolutely, we are shifting what the reality of entertainment is with our every project. And micro studios are the way it's at. I had a podcast that I was hosting in 2009, 2010. Good Lord, when did we first start? Long time ago. And one of the things that we talked about in the roundtable discussion was the rise of the micro studio post-economic downfall. And of course, now in COVID land, we're not having movie openings. There aren't red carpets and who are you wearing and, you know, opening weekend box office receipts to look at. This is available on demand, and that is teaching the big guys what it feels like to play on a playing field that we've already gotten used to. We know what VOD is. We know how that works, and now they're experiencing it too at a different level. And that coming together to me feels so next chapter. I love it.
Yeah, I think be your own studio is the way to go, and that's not just for actors. I mean, that's for, you know, you could be in any walk of life, but you can be your own media company, you know, with all these platforms. And then to kind of bring this full circle, the data is what's more powerful, because you never had that. Like, I put my trailer on Facebook. I all of a sudden know who my demographic is. Now I know who's interested. Okay, it's not a full picture, but it's much better than just putting it out there randomly, paying $20,000 for a TV commercial spot, which I couldn't do anyway.
Yes, all of that.
Now you go to the distributor, and now you say, hey, distributor, I got a film. It's got a market in Argentina, Chile, and the U.S. Great.
Exactly. You go to them with now not just a pitch of, here's this great idea. Don't I look good on camera? It's edited really well. The sound is awesome. You have all that. Plus, take a look at the eyeballs I can get. Like, and showing people that you already have an audience is the quickest way to get them to say, okay, yes, and.
And people might get scared by that, because I think they think, oh, I don't have thousands of dollars to invest in doing some ad. No, like, you can run a few ads for $20-$30. It's not much data, but it's still better than it's some data.
And on that, let's be clear, the longer you run even $5 a week of ads, the smarter they become. And the more data you get that becomes really usable. Like we're in a state right now, we only took out our first ads in quarter four, 2019. Had never, ever, ever advertised in 20 years of this business. And decided now it's time. Now we have a program, a membership that we know works, that we know is changing lives, and it converts well. So we just need to get it in front of more eyeballs. So we're like, it's time. We do it, and we do it okay. And then we recalibrate based on what we're learning, and we start getting more of the right people. And then we take a look again, recalibrate some more, spend money differently, try different assets. And again, the ads get smarter, the ads get smarter. On this last wave of registration for Getting Gear for the Next Year, we had the like textbook perfect people enroll. Like the comments they're leaving on every day's course are like, my heart is so full of this is exactly the work we're doing. And this is the exact right person to benefit from this. And it's not one or two people. It's all the people that registered are showing me that we went out and got the right people through the ads. And we did that on not a very big budget. It's possible to align with your exact perfect people if you're in it for the long game. I cannot state that more and have it land differently. It is always long game, long game, long game. Because if you're like, no, I'm taking out an ad for a week and I hope it's going to give me eyeballs. Like I don't have enough followers on Facebook. It's like, give it time. Be consistent, show up with the work, and you will build the following.
Yeah. It's also being in the long game dictates what your messaging is, though, because if you're not in it for the long game, your messaging is going to be very much sell, 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 because that's what people are taught. Whereas actually, you're just trying to build a brand, and that doesn't happen overnight. Even though you're an established brand, new top of funnel people to you don't know you. But this is a really crazy time because this data world and the creative world that were always so separate, as someone who's been in both for so many years, now they're like all part of the same thing. And you need to have an appreciation of both. You need to be able to say, I'm a creative, but I also need to understand how I can figure out who my audience is. And oh my God, I couldn't do that before, but how many people are resonating with this piece of content that's talking about this in this particular way? And, you know, how do I engage past customers and past fans, and how do I engage new fans? And I think that people still, I don't think, are fully tweaked on to what that is yet, but it's getting there.
Well, let's take it into the real world, which is as
I'm just going to turn on a light because I realize how dark I am.
It's getting really sexy. I was like, are we getting into the after dark part of the show? Yeah, do it.
2 seconds. My agent won't approve. Otherwise, I would.
All right, fair enough. All right, you turn on the light. I will refill my fizzy water. There we go.
And okay, I'm back.
Let's take it to the real world, which is you as an actor have data of which casting directors you've auditioned for that call you in again and again. They are your fan base. You booked the room. Even if you've never booked a role with them, you've booked the room, or else they would never have you back in. Here's how you know a casting director is not in your, we call it population of thirds, which is there's a third of the population that's your super fan, third of your population that's like, I don't get it. And there's a third of the population that just outright hates you. And that's chemical. You know, if you've ever been gone into a party and seen someone and just been like, nope, like you know, you couldn't force it. So that's population of thirds. You know, when someone is in your third, when they are your fan, even if you have not booked, they call you in again and again. Your work is to not go, how do I make all casting directors feel the same? It's what are the things about this casting director and her worldview and the way she populates stories and the people she does business with that I need to now look at as who else is doing that? Because there's someone who's coming up decades behind her who's just starting their casting business that you actually can have access to right now. And that person is the future of where you are with this person. And you can go ahead and start making things happen at both levels simultaneously. And that's how we start getting those low level early wins that then create momentum for the long game. And then that starts to catch up. And then it's like, where'd you come from? Out of nowhere. Like, I can't go anywhere without hearing your name. That's how we wrangle that.
Yeah. I love that. There's also, if we take the aspect of some of that data and applying it to ads just quickly, if we're talking about, okay, I know that these shows and these kinds of directors or these actors are the kinds of actors that I more vibe with, not that you're bypassing what you're talking about with The Office is, because those are people that you need to have relationships with. But if you can go to them and say, okay, but I've got a group of fans. Maybe it's only 3,000, 4,000, whatever it is. It doesn't matter the number. It's not huge, but you've got a fan base. They engage in your content. And you've been able to curate them because you know from the data and all the work you talk about that you can put ads in front of people that are fans of such and such a show and right. whatever other parameters. As an example, or you've done a short film. I take an example of, you know, something I've done that has a certain vibe. Okay, well, if you liked, for example, Philomena, which is similar to the short film that I did in terms of theme, and you also like short films, then I'm going to show you an ad and I'm going to tailor my creative to that. Or as another example, I knew one of my lead actors was from Boston. Target only Boston and have a picture of him and say Boston's own in this film. Contextual advertising from a creative perspective, actually from the stats, has much stronger engagement rates. And as an actor, you might think, how can you use that? I'm going to throw back to what you once said to me, which I never heard from anyone before, which was, you have a case of the Gyllenhaals. You were the first, you were the first person to say that. I called my doctor pretty quickly because I thought it was condition. Luckily it wasn't. Now everybody brings that up, so I'm like, okay, well, Bonnie obviously as always saw it first. But when I've run ads, I can now run ads against people that are fans of Jake Gyllenhaal,
absolutely,
and like all these other and my point with this is, if you're an actor who's done the data and the work that you've done, you could build a following by doing a few small ads with $20 to show them your demo reel, your one scene, your whatever. And then you build an audience that doesn't bypass the networks and studios, but it shows them like, I have a fan base.
Absolutely. And it's if you really want to get nerdy with this, there's a story from years back, and if you've not seen it, I'll send you the link to it, where a guy used Facebook ads to target his roommate to get him to do chores.
Amazing.
It's genius. And of course, you know exactly how you could make that happen. But it was like things that were showing up in the guy's feed were, they kept being like really creepily specific. So there is a way to, if you're like, I need to get in front of this person, there's a way. If they are on the internet, there is a way to make that happen. Of course, you use this power for good, not for evil. You find ways to get yourself those eyeballs that you say you're ready for, but let's be sure that that part is taken care of. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things I see happen is people start to learn cool little hacks like this, mm-hmm. and they've not yet done the work of understanding who they are as storytellers. They've not declared their true north. They don't know, their craft's not even that great. And it's like, oh, you've got these great ways that you can get in front of people, but then you can't deliver when you're in the room, or you freak out once you actually get invited in. Like, that enoughness has to be dealt with.
Agreed. These are tools. And also, I need to probably say from my digital marketing side, GDPR, which means don't just take someone's email without their consent and spam them, because that's not fucking cool.
I regularly get emails from people who've added me to some stupid list of like, oh, this is a casting director, let me spam her. And I'm like, immediately I hit the thing that's like, nope, complaint. And it makes me so sad that they didn't even do the work. My DMs every day at Instagram, cast me, here's my demo reel, here's my headshot. I'm like, what am I working on right now that you know you want to be a part of? Because the number of them that even have any clue what I work on is tiny. And those, of course, who know what I work on also know what I've written, and they've read it, and they know target, long game. Don't just go, hey, Bonnie, you need to know me. Really make sure that we've built a relationship so that I understand that you're a solution to problems that I regularly have.
Yeah. And I think, you know, with these platforms, it's realizing that, you know, it's not, if you're a consumer, Facebook is just Facebook. If you're a creator, Facebook isn't Facebook. Facebook is NBC, Facebook is CBS. And then you'd go, well, I wouldn't just go on The Tonight Show if I didn't have my shit together. And it's the same thing, like, you know.
Exactly that.
So yes, the tools are great. They're powerful no matter what business you're doing. But you got to make that first impression count. And then if you have that ready, it's the best way. You can put a commercial in front of somebody. Couldn't do that before. So it's crazy times. All right, Bonnie, I'm mindful of time and I could probably wax lyrical with you forever.
I love all the places this conversation has gone. I'm like, this is seriously so much fun.
And I'm mindful of people's attention spans too. So I wanted to still be kind of tuning in and listening to some of this stuff and not, you know, having checked out when we're talking about Bruce Lipton, for example. I wrap these up with the James Lipton. Wow, that was not a planned segue. I wrap these up with James Lipton's Inside the Actor's Studio questions. So if you're game, we'll do a quick sort of 2 or 3 minute quick fire of those 10 questions and then we'll just wrap it up.
Cool.
Or as you would call this, brand prov.
It is brand prov. Yes. My answers do not have to be true. They only have to be on brand.
There we go. So the first question is, what is your favorite word?
I used to play along with this with his show and I would say fuck just because I just love the irreverence of it. I'm going to change that though to modern me. It's enoughness. It's enoughness.
What's your least favorite word?
Impossible.
What turns you on in a creative, spiritual, intellectual kind of way?
The willingness to have the hard conversations and stay in the room while they get ugly.
Mm. That covers all spectrums of life, right? Yep. That's an enoughness thing right there.
Yeah.
Oof. What turns you off from the flip side of that?
Vapid banality. Just like, can we talk about my eyelash extensions or whatever? Like, just no.
Yeah, there's enough of that going around. Fifth question is optional, which is, what's your favorite curse word? You kind of already answered it.
Oh, I did. Yeah, that's fuck. That's definitely fuck.
Yeah. What is your favorite sound or noise?
Laughter.
And what's your least favorite sound or noise?
Oh, my God. There is a FedEx delivery truck or a UPS delivery truck that comes over to this. There's a church right here every day, 5 o'clock. And they leave the key in and the door open and go into the church and it's going ding, 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 because the key is, and they stay in and talk and hang out for like 20 minutes. And so for 20 minutes, I have the, anything like that, that just, no, I go, this is how I die right here. Yeah.
It gets under your skin.
Yep.
He's asking to be carjacked, surely.
Yeah, I know.
You're in a nice neighborhood, but still, like.
Yeah.
What job or profession, other than your own or the ones you've attempted, I guess, or done in past lives, would you most want to attempt?
I really do just anything I want to try, I try. So that there's not something that I would want to do that I couldn't or haven't tried, but maybe like professional athlete or something that's just like elite, just that discipline of the training and the being up against the best all the time, like that kind of stuff.
Which you kind of indirectly do with your mindset work anyway. It's sort of this. It's similar kind of wheelhouse.
Different gym, yeah.
What job or profession would you never want to do then?
I probably would never want to work in a corporate environment of a cube farm and fluorescent lights. Like, it's not even so much what I would be doing as the environment. It just feels very gray to me.
I
like the color experience.
Don't know what you're talking about. It's fantastic. Whenever I did it, it was amazing.
Best part of your life?
Best part of my, I mean, you learn.
Can't wait to go to work.
Well, you learn some stuff. Maybe not the stuff that, you know, you learn that you don't want to do it, I think.
Yeah. Well, and knowing your don't wants is a great starting point.
Yeah, but then knowing when to get out of it is probably also important too, because it's the matrix. It's that whole kind of thing.
That part of the matrix. I don't want that. Yes.
Final question, which I think you probably have this already well in your brain answered, and it's all over your website probably too, which is, when it's all said and done, what would you like the story of your life to be? So what impact do you want to have had?
I used to say that this would be, she left Hollywood better than she found it. Bigger picture, everyone she encountered could say, better for it, better for it, better for it. It doesn't just have to be Hollywood, but definitely leaving Hollywood better than I found it. That, because I kind of feel like I've already done that. That one's up and running. Like it, that's in process and continuing to have that reach. But I like, even on the micro, the one-to-one, having, I'm better for this conversation, even if it challenged me, even if it wasn't fun in the having of it right now, I'm better for it. Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's something that has always been there as part of your ethos. I think having worked with you for all these years, whenever we've had conversations, that's always been something that I think has naturally come out of it. Even when you maybe had tough times in your own life, you've always brought that out no matter what. And I think that's a discipline in of itself. So I think you're doing that, maybe not on autopilot, but it looks or feels like you are sometimes.
Well, if my work is pulling back the curtain, let's go back to 1999, it's to pull back the curtain on this mystery of showbiz and how things are being done. It would be disingenuous if I didn't pull back the curtain on my own experience. And so part of that transparency and authenticity is baked in for me, while still having boundaries. And that's the part where it gets challenging, is just knowing, like, at what point are you just spewing all your stuff versus I'm sharing because it helps, and just really having that ability to keep an eye on what is in service of that big why, to go back to Simon Sinek again.
Absolutely. Awesome. That's a nice full circle, I think, to the whole conversation. Well, look, Bonnie, I guess final moment to you, really, if there's anything that you want to leave people with as a parting thought or idea or mantra as a final takeaway, what sure. would that be?
Every moment is a choice. Really, every word, every breath, every bite, every sip, every step, it's every click, every scroll, it's a choice. We get in this place of turning our choices into our identity, and saying, well, I scroll for hours on Facebook because that's what I do, or I scroll, you know, I ate this, so I have to eat all of this, or my story for so long was I'm a drinker, and now I'm sober almost 4 years. It's like there are things that I think become our identity because there's momentum for them, and that ability to say every moment is a choice allows you to choose differently. And we've got trillions of cells that are regenerating constantly. We can be entirely, and in fact are entirely, new humans every few minutes, technically. So we can make different choices in so many areas, and that's the more empowering way to go.